Good morning. This is Focus 580, a morning telephone talk show. Welcome back to the second hour of the show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Our producer is Harriet Williamson and Travis Stansel, and glad to have you listening. If you were really good at mathematics, would it help you do well in the stock market? During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with a mathematician who lost his shirt on Wall Street. We like irony here. John Allen Paulos is a professor of mathematics and former presidential scholar at Temple University, and he's a frequent media commentator on the intersection of mathematics, the news, and everyday life. You may have seen some of his other books. He's the author of seven, including the best-selling Innumeracy and A Mathematician Reads the Newspaper, which recently came out. His latest book is A Mathematician Plays the Stock Market, just published by Basic Books. In this book, John Allen Paulos tells of his own humbling experience in the stock market, then goes on to explore the mathematical concepts that, had he actually used them at the time, might, and I emphasize the word might, have saved him a great deal of money and angst. As we talk with John Allen Paulos, you are welcome to join our conversation. We are not offering stock advice in particular during this hour, but questions on the math of the stock market and the topic that we're going to be talking about. Those questions are welcome. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us around the Midwest or actually anywhere in the U.S. if you're listening on the web. That number is 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And John Allen Paulos joins us this morning by telephone. Professor Paulos, good morning.
Good morning, or good afternoon here. But
right. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Before we dive in, we should probably make very clear that your book is not intended to offer advice on particular investments.
That's correct. I don't have any what I call financial pornography in it. No five stocks for the new decade or 10 stocks to send your kid to college or anything of the sort.
Especially not WorldCom.
Especially not WorldCom, which provides my misadventure with said company provides a kind of narrative thread holding the book together, and it's even now excruciating to recall some of the details.
Right. Well, I know from, you know, reading this book and others, I read Innumeracy certainly a few years ago, that you're a very rational being. But perhaps didn't behave as such with regard to WorldCom. And maybe I could ask you to talk a little bit about your experience there and sort of what drew you into the market.
Well, I spend a lot of time on the net, and so I was perhaps particularly vulnerable to WorldCom spiel. It owned the UUNet, the so-called backbone to the Internet. It owned the MCI, had a lot of revenue. I read the George Gilder's rhapsodizing about the pleasures of almost unlimited bandwidth. So I received some unexpected money, put it into WorldCom, in part because of telecommunications, strong buys, and so on. But I then became subject to what is sometimes called confirmation bias, which is one of many psychological foibles or cognitive illusions that I discuss. And it's nothing more than the tendency, once one makes a decision, to thereafter look for all sorts of reasons that suggest it was a brilliant decision and ignore factors which suggest otherwise. So when it fell in price, it was a good deal at $40. It was an even better deal at $30. So I averaged down, which is sometimes tantamount to catching a falling knife, and kept on doing so. And all the while, kind of scorning the herd, which was fleeing WorldCom in droves. And so I think arrogance and greed were part of my motivation. And did all sorts of silly and, in retrospect, stupid things, buying calls, buying on margin, and continuing to buy and not diversify. I mean, in the past, I had most of my assets in index funds, and it was a strange aberration which overcame me, which even now is somewhat difficult to explain to myself.
But it's actually the behavior of the market itself in many ways.
It is. I mean, the market, as well as the individuals in it, are largely rational beasts. occasionally provoked by their underlying animal spirits, and that was certainly the case with WorldCom or the market in general. I mean, it followed the psychological pattern of previous hysterias dating back to the tulip bulb craze in Holland in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks they can get off, sit down when the music stops, but they're generally mistaken, and lots of chairs are taken away, and there's no place to sit.
A great analogy. Well, this brings to mind the phrase that you use, being right versus being right about the market. I mean, you had sound rational reasons for picking and staying with WorldCom, which you revisited even when its stock price was tanking. But in fact, the market doesn't behave based on simply rational reasoning sort of facts.
No, that's why, I mean, what I explore at length in a book is the interplay between the mathematics and the psychology. And as you just mentioned, I mean, you can be, in some sense, right, but if everyone else is doing something else or is acting on rumors which are false or ill-founded or silly, you can't afford to ignore them. In fact, in the book, I liken the position of investors in the market to, John Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, who likened the position of investors in the market to reader judges in newspaper beauty contests, which were popular in his day. And the newspaper would run like pictures of hundreds of young women, and you had to pick the five prettiest, and the newspaper gave a prize to that person whose list of the five prettiest matched the list of the most popular as judged by all of its readers. So you couldn't just rely on your own personal taste. You had to anticipate what average opinion would deem the five prettiest women to be. And since everybody was doing the same thing, it was more complicated than that. You had to anticipate what average opinion would anticipate average opinion would deem the five prettiest, and so on. And so likewise, in the market, you have to assess other investors as much as other investors. The investments itself, and assessing investors is often a more daunting task.
Mm-hmm. You say understanding the notion of common knowledge is crucial to understanding the stock market.
Right. I mean, common knowledge is a technical notion. I give some puzzles. Throughout the book, I try to avoid, and in fact, I think do avoid, equations and formulas, but try to get the ideas across via puzzles, vignettes, stories, and so on. But common knowledge is just a notion that's distinct from mutual knowledge. Two people might know the same facts, but if they don't know that the other one knows it, this is not common knowledge. Common knowledge is mutual knowledge plus the awareness that other people know the bit of information that you do and know that they know, and so on. And this kind of knowledge is activating, is motivating. People buy and sell on it, and the interplay between the two is a complicated one.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you know that somebody else knows something and know that they know you know that they know, boy, that gets really convoluted, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. In fact, I mean, there's a puzzle that's kind of marginally relevant to the Keynes story as well. If you have to, let's say there's a group of people, and the directions are to these people to pick a number between 0 and 100, and you announce that you're going to give a big prize, let's say $10,000, to that person whose pick is closest to 80% of the average of the numbers picked by everybody in the room. So you might think, well, I don't understand that very well, or they're not going to pay attention. But the other people might think, well, gee, if people pick numbers at random, the average is going to be 50. If I pick 80% of 50, which is 40, I should win the prize. Get closest to 80% of the average. But other people, you look around, look kind of insightful, and they might be thinking the same way, so they may pick a number around 40. So you say, well, maybe everybody will do that. I'll pick 80% of 40, or 32, or maybe a bit more, because not everybody will think that. And you might look around and say, well, maybe everybody will think this as well, so maybe 80% of 32 is the way to go. In any case, I mean, in some sense, the right number, the right answer mathematically is zero. It's 80% of itself. It can't be improved upon. it's the so-called Nash equilibrium. But if you pick zero, you'd almost definitely be wrong, because most people won't cut so trenchantly to the heart of the matter. And here again, you've got to assess the other contestants as well as the contest itself. Just as in the market, you have to assess investor psychology and knowledge and so on, as well as fundamentals of the stock itself.
So in many ways, this is like the stock market.
It is. It's this interplay between, as I say, psychology and mathematics is a murky one and poorly understood. There are a lot of so-called cognitive illusions, psychological foibles. I mean, another one is goes by the name of anchoring effects. You give a number to somebody, and they tend to either believe it or think it's approximately true, whether it has anything to do with reality or not. I mean, the 52-week high or the expected earnings and so on have a kind of magnetizing effect. Once the number's out there, it needn't have any connection to reality. People kind of are anchored to it, and people suffer from, as I mentioned, confirmation bias. Their attitudes towards risks. Risk is not always rational. People take much bigger risk to avoid loss than they do to achieve gain, and they construct mental accounts that have no basis in reality, and partition their assets into these accounts even though money is fungible, and a host of other irrational ways of dealing and categorizing money and assets. And all of these have an impact on stocks and economic behavior, and in fact is the subject of a new area of finance known as behavioral finance.
Well, I hope we can follow up and talk about some of these things in more detail. We do have a caller to include in our conversation. I want to do that and also let people know that we're talking with John Allen Paulos. He's a professor of mathematics at Temple University in Philadelphia, author of a number of books. The one we're discussing today is his latest, A Mathematician Plays the Stock Market, published by Basic Books. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Savoy on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. Hey, this is a real interesting conversation. I do a lot of mathematical modeling, in particular dynamic simulation of industrial systems.
Mm-hmm.
And, these systems can be really complex, and the way we describe them, of course, is with differential equations, and the final rates of change are based on the summation of all the derivatives plus and minus, and you get a rate of change. And looking at stock charts and everything, they look like the output of a bunch of simultaneous differential equations. And so you could have a derivative for the psychology factor, and then all you have to do is just figure out some way to measure it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a rational way. It just has to be, a way of measuring and then weight it somehow. And you ought to be able to mimic the output of a typical stock chart by just using differential equations.
Well, that sounds nice. I am afraid that if it were quite as easy as you described it, there'd be a lot of mathematical modelers who would be extraordinarily wealthy.
You'd be surprised how inept economists are.
I wouldn't actually. But nevertheless, I mean, there are all kinds of tools that have been devised to
right.
I mean, from basic ones like technical analysis charts and so on, which doesn't seem to have any evidence in its favor, little evidence in its favor, fundamental analysis, various ratios, dividend yields, and so on.
These are all what we call statistical and static methods.
Right. I mean, people have used more technical methods. I mean, used tools from chaos theory, network theory, power laws, and so on, and all kinds of multiple regressions. And
like I said, that's not that's not the way you model industrial systems.
Right. But it's still, I think. I mean, you said look at the derivative of the psychology factor.
Right.
That sounds nice, but it is, I think, perhaps quite glib to dismiss the complicated, convoluted psychology of people as the derivative of the psychology factor. I mean, it actually, I think, you know, has no cash value.
Well, all you need is just a good relationship with a good psychiatrist, you know, and you can compute your psychology factor every day. Hey,
yeah.
I'll tell you what, this is a real interesting subject, and you know, and I was just wondering, you know, if I've seen a lot of methods that are technical and static based and statistically based, and I'll tell you what, they're worthless.
I think I agree.
And then I was just curious if you'd ever heard of anybody trying to describe it using differential equations.
Well, not differential equations. I mean, yeah, of course, people. I mean, you'd probably use difference equations since things are not continuous but discrete. But yeah, there are all sorts of people devising methods. One problem is that's assume, contrary to fact, that people use, you know, all these exotic tools and they come up with something that works. They would have to keep it secret.
Because that's right. Yeah.
Were it to become known, the temporary advantage it confers would be arbitraged away.
Hey, it's really nice talking to you.
Okay, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, bye.
Very interesting.
Bye-bye.
Well, we can talk more about the various models or methods of technical and other kinds of analysis as we continue our conversation. We do have another caller waiting, and let's include them. This is someone in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi.
Yes.
I think that last call was a little bit humorous. I don't think he has known much about what the reality is, but I was just curious.
I think it's all in good fun.
Yeah. But I was wondering if there was a article in the Chicago Sun-Times back in April which brought up something that I learned in business school, and that is that it starts out talking about how so many people have tried to crack the stock market, and a lot of Nobel Prizes have been won. And my professors agreed that the only thing of any real value that's come out of all this is the idea of the beta. And I was curious as whether or not Dr. Paolo said what his opinion of it was, if he's had any experience adjusting the beta on his portfolio, and maybe if he's familiar with it, he could explain it better than I could.
Sure. I mean, beta is just a measure of the relative volatility of a stock. If a stock has a beta of 1, it's as volatile as the market as a whole. If it has a beta of 2, it's twice as volatile. So if the market goes up 2%, it'll go up 4%, or so the theory goes. If it has a beta of 0.5, that's a utility stock, it's much less volatile than a market as a whole. If the market goes up 2%, it'll go up 1%. If the market goes down 6%, it'll go down 3%. In any case, it's like many mathematical tools, it sounds nice, but whether there's any whether beta is constant over time is another question, and the answer is not generally. And so it's useful as kind of a rough tool, but it's not a panacea to anything. I mean, the thing is that the market is, I mean, to get away a bit from the question, the market is largely efficient. Efficient meaning new information is quickly adapted to and reflected in the prices of the stock. And because of that, it's hard to do better than index funds. It's, you know, there are pockets of exploitability that are very evanescent, because once something works for a while, you use some bit of tool from technical analysis, moving average rules, or something about the ratios from fundamental analysis. You buy, you know, the dogs of the Dow or whatever. Once something works for a while, other people move in and, as I say, arbitrage away the difference. So the market is largely efficient, although not completely. The strong versions of the efficient market hypothesis are easy to parody. two efficient market theorists are walking down the street and they see a $100 bill on the curb, and one of them says to the other, "I'll leave it. If it was real, it would have been picked up by now." I mean, the market isn't that efficient. I mean, sometimes you can move in and exploit an opportunity. But oddly, the efficient market hypothesis is true to the extent that people believe it to be false. It's kind of a paradoxical result, because if people think the market is not efficient, what will they do? They'll use every tool in the book, every ratio, every chart, everything they can think of to get an edge or get an angle, and by all these exertions, they'll make the market efficient. And if they think the market is efficient, they won't do anything. They'll leave their stocks and funds where they are for decades at a time, and the market will grow sluggish. So it's a strange sort of hypothesis that's at the basis of much of the market theory, which is that the efficient market hypothesis is true to the extent most investors think it to be false.
So you despite all the recent corporate scandals, you really think the market is pretty much efficient all in all, huh?
Well, I mean, if people lie, that's something else. I mean, accounting fraud and analyst management collusion, where analysts sell strong buys in order to get investment banking fees. I mean, that's bad. That's awful. I hope people go to jail. But nevertheless, on the whole, I think the market is largely efficient. Not always, in their pockets, as they say, of exploitability, predictability, which tend to disappear.
But by your own admission, if there are such pockets of exploitability, they would be best held close to the chest, and wouldn't hear about it.
Right.
But anyway, I'm enjoying this. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Another element of market psychology that you raise, I think, is a very interesting one. Investors' belief about stocks or a method of picking them can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. For example, if enough people suddenly believe in a stock, for that reason alone, its price will go up and it'll justify their belief.
Right, for certainly for a while. I mean, and so if a lot of people are following some wacky theory, whether there's any long-term validity to it is not the point. I mean, if, as you said, if enough people believe it, it's going to move the stock, and you have to take that into account. That's why, you can't be too dismissive of popular delusions or psychology or whatever, since it impacts your stock.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not to raise WorldCom again, but it seems that that dynamic was very much not just in the case of WorldCom, but Amazon.com, all the .coms essentially were beneficiaries, at least for a time, of this sort of herd mentality that when no price is too high to pay for the stock.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, having lost a lot of money in WorldCom, I talked to a lot of people who also lost money in the stock, as well as Adelphia, Enron, Tyco, and so on.
Peapod, and, you name it.
Right, yeah, and Lucent even. And and people, I think that to some extent they're a little too quick to see themselves as victims of these various corporate villains. I mean, they were in a sense, but they were also, in the late 90s, beneficiaries of these same villains and their shady practices. And made a lot of money in the late 90s. So investors are, to some extent, complicit and bear some of the responsibility for the bubble. It's not just a few bad guys.
We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is John Allen Paulos. He's professor of mathematics at Temple University, author of a number of books, including the one we're discussing, his latest, A Mathematician Plays the Stock Market, recently published by Basic Books. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we have one person waiting and several lines open. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Eureka on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I wonder if your speaker could talk about index funds. let's say, index funds versus the total market. I understand that there is a difference.
Well, it depends on what the index is, but I mean, when I say index funds, I mean very broadly based index funds, like a total stock index. And there, it's the case, as I mentioned, that even highly paid fund managers, on average, don't do better than index funds, which is a kind of underreported financial scandal, in my opinion. And, I mean, as long as there are enough people out there trying to get an edge and keeping the market on its toes and efficient, you can't do much better than index funds. It was interesting that Eliot Spitzer, the Attorney General in New York, who's prosecuting a lot of companies and individuals, held a press conference at Investor Forum magazine a few months ago. He was speaking at a dinner that was honoring brokers, and he had the temerity to point out that many of the brokers being honored didn't have particularly stellar stock picking records. In fact, had quite mediocre stock picking records. And it seemed that there was a duh response was called for. I mean, it's kind of analogous to Donald Trump holding a press conference in Atlantic City and pointing out that his roulette players don't do particularly well. I mean, I think stocks do better than casinos. I mean, you make money in the long run on stocks, whereas you lose money in the long run at casinos. But the principle is the same. You're not going to do much better than the expected value of whatever game you're playing.
Well, I've heard just a couple. These may not be correct, but in terms of total markets, there's a couple I've heard about. I think it's Wilshire 5000 and a Russell 2000.
Now, right, those would be good.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thanks. We said we weren't going to give out investment advice, but you know, you can't help comment. I did want to ask you to follow up on this thing about the winners in the investment fund. The analysts, the people who say here's what's going to happen with the market or with this company or with this set of stocks. You explain how this, the winners essentially, if you look at the overall numbers, in many ways, it's just random. And yet we reward these people who call the winning picks as if they were somehow geniuses.
Right. I mean, there might be something to feel for the market. I think there probably is, but it's vastly overstated. I mean, there's standard arguments that show. I mean, for example, you have a 1,000 investors. I mean, half of them will do better than index next year.
Mm-hmm.
Half of those. So you have 500. Half of those, 250, will do better 2 years in a row. And half of those, 125, 3 years in a row, just by chance. So there'll be one out of the 1,000 that will be do better than the indexes 10 years in a row. And he'll be featured, no doubt, on the cover of Money Magazine or Forbes or Fortune, whatever. And his success is would be due to nothing more than chance. It's perhaps it's a little bit analogous to the Sports Illustrated cover jinx. The magazine features on its covers athletes that have had a particularly wonderful season or set of accomplishments, and many people think that appearing on the cover is a jinx because thereafter the player's performance the following year or the following month is much worse, or he breaks his leg or whatever. And it's, people attribute this to some kind of jinx-like phenomenon. One is more likely just a consequence of regression to the mean. I mean, extreme performances are followed by performances that are closer to the average. Likewise, players that have had a particularly bad year often have a year that's not quite as bad the year after. And in the business world, I mean, Bernie Ebers and Dennis Kozlowski and Ken Lay and all these, his whole litany of villains were on the cover of every business magazine under the sun in the late 90s, and now they've had some bad years, and so has everybody else, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the common schools of thought or strategies among active investors. We sort of alluded to, for example, technical analysis, and you spend a good deal of time in the book talking about the techniques of technical analysis and whether one can profit by using such techniques.
Right. I know one out of the nine chapters, but it attempts to look at patterns of stock prices and by and by looking at them, determine which ones presage, you know, upsurges, and which ones suggest otherwise. And there are various notions, moving averages, you average the price for the last 10 days or 200 days, and resistance and support and so on. And people devise rules whose intent is, as I said, to look for arcane signals of upsurges. The problem is there isn't a whole lot of evidence that it works. I mean, people who subscribe to them generally do so fervently, but there's a tendency to kind of to subscribe to wishful thinking or to data mine. Data mine just means looking at past performance with sufficient vigilance and sufficient care to determine patterns that worked in the past and say, well, if we had done this, we would have made all this money. I mean, but it's, of course, easy to predict the past. The key is to predict the future. And as I say, I mean, some things work occasionally for a short period of time, and the notions are helpful. It's helpful to know what other investors are talking about, so I do explicate them in the book. But as long as there are people out making the market more or less efficient, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of evidence for the efficacy of technical analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, there also seems to be a certain amount of faith in the tools, and so therefore people behave in particular ways that correspond to the psychology of the market.
Right, and that's, again, getting back to the, at least in the short term, and probably only in the short term, self-fulfilling aspects of many of these techniques, which come in and out of fashion. I mean, the dogs of the Dow suggest that you buy the 10 stocks among the Dow 30 with the lowest PD ratio, price to dividend. They're doing badly, but they're Dow stocks, so they're not going to go under, and hope that there'll be a regression to the mean, they'll do better. And this worked for a while. People made money on it for a while, and then it stopped working as more people used it, and it's beginning to work again. I mean, people often say, you know, I use this or that or the other technique, and I make money, and who are you to tell me otherwise? And the question, and my response is, of course, you make money. That's not the point. The point is, do you make more money on average and over the long run than you would if you invested in index funds? And there, the evidence is far from compelling.
That's really interesting.
I mean, it suggests that you don't. Investing strategies are, in a sense, like diets. I mean, you can lose weight on virtually any diet. The question is, do you lose more weight on that over time and on, let's say, an Atkins diet than you do on following the common sense counsel of limiting calories, exercising, eating a balanced diet, and so on. And it's not so clear.
We have about 15 minutes left with our guest, John Allen Paulus, talking about his book, A Mathematician Plays the Stock Market. We have a couple of callers to include in our conversation, and I'll mention the numbers again, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else in the U.S., you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Spring Bay on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. Yeah, I've just read Warren Buffett's biography, and you were talking about these different stock pickers and all that. And what I like about his story is it seems like he made it the old-fashioned way with reading company reports and doing his homework and all of that. A great stock picker. What comments would you have to make about him as perhaps standing apart from the herd and being so successful for so many years in a row? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. And that brings up the topic of value investing, I believe.
Right. Value investing, you look for stocks with a low P ratio, with good fundamentals and so on, and look at gross economic factors like the interest rate and so on. The thing about Warren Buffett, I mean, he does certainly have, if anyone does, probably a feel for the market, but to some extent, his success is exaggerated because he's no longer an independent stock picker who makes his picks in secret, and then miraculously the next year they do wonderfully. For two reasons. One, when he decides to invest in a company, I mean, the mere fact that he's investing induces, in some cases, a follow Warren effect. I mean, Warren Buffett's investing, let's invest too. So, in that sense, I mean, he kind of increases his probability that his picks will be successful, more successful than if he made it in private. The other is because he's got such resources, he can divert some of his assets to new investments, and thereby ensuring their to some extent their profitability. So, you know, I don't want to demean his accomplishments in any way, but they are perhaps a bit overhyped. I mean, if you just ask him to pick 10 stocks and put them on a piece of paper and don't tell anybody, it's not clear that he'd do that much better than anybody else.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. We have several people waiting. We'll go next to a listener in southeastern Illinois on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. I haven't mentioned the pleasure that is in the market. I mean, the amount of for example, I don't know how much you lost, and it probably would be quite a bit. But it's an experience that one of the principal experiences in your life. I mean, if you live to be 90 years old, that is going to be something that will be a high spot or a low spot, but an important spot in your life.
And
for that, that's one thing. And another thing is, and I'm not mathematically literate, so I don't know, but figuring losses. It'd be interesting to see how the way a number of people figure losses. For example, somebody buys a stock at $25 a share. They buy 100 shares for $2,500. The stock rises to $70 a share. They now have $7,000. Then the stock plummets to $10 a share. When you ask them, how much did you lose in the market, are they going to tell you that they lost $1,500, or are they going to tell you they lost $6,000?
Right.
All right. Yeah, of course. No, about your first point, I agree. There is a certain pleasure in the market, and that's why, I mean, even though index funds, for most people, should probably be the core of their holdings, I mean, it's nice to invest in individual stocks for the pure entertainment value. It's nice to have a horse in a race and root for what you kind of arbitrarily define to be the home team. Now, I can't deny that. As far as the other point, there's a little story about the fungibility of money and the cognitive foibles that I tell, among others. As it concerns a newlywed who wakes up in Las Vegas in the middle of the night, and he sees one $5 chip on his dresser. So he takes it down to the casino, and he goes to the roulette wheel, puts it on number 17, and lo and behold, it comes up, 35-1 odds. He's got about $175 now. He puts the whole $175 down on 17. It comes up again. He's got $6,000, whatever. He does it again. He's got thousands of dollars. Does it one more time, and he's got $200,000. And he's going to go home. But finally, he thinks that he can't lose. He goes to a different casino because the first one won't allow him to put so much money down on 17. He puts it down. He gets it. He's got $7.5 million. He starts walking home. He figures, what the heck? I'll do it one more time. He puts it down one more time, and 19 comes up. He loses everything, and he stumbles back shell-shocked to his hotel room, and his wife wakes up groggily and asks him where he was, and he says he's out gambling on roulette, and she says, how'd you do? And he says, not too bad. I lost $5. So, again, it's your same question in a slightly more elaborate form. Did he lose $5, or did he lose $7.5 million?
Yeah, it's generally, when you're telling people later, you'll tell them he lost $7.5 million. I have.
And in a sense, he did. It's
right.
From a standpoint of age and economic situation, I have no business being in the market at all, and to the extent that I'm in small amounts, and I've had no business being in it since I've been in it ever since the late 1960s. But it's been fascinating, and it's something to very seldom that a horse will drop dead in the race. They just keep running, sometimes ahead, sometimes behind. But all of these Enrons and WorldComs and everything, the most money that I think, and as I say, these are small sums that I'm talking about. The most money that I've lost on a stock was on something as a banal as Kmart. So you can lose it anywhere.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. We have another caller waiting on line number 2 on a cell phone. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I just wanted to make a brief comment. I'm a theoretical physicist, and I've been teaching computational econophysics for a number of years, specifically to economics and finance majors. And I want to tell you, I really enjoyed your book. I've always enjoyed all of your books. This one I was specifically impressed by. And I just wanted to say, I've been trying to explain to my students about how irrational behavior can't really lead to rational, or I should say individual irrational behavior can't lead to rational market behavior. And they keep saying, well, why do certain systems work? And what I just heard you say is absolutely a brilliant answer, which is that, by analogy, almost any diet works on the short term, even if it's not based on any sound scientific principle. The question is, does anything work in the long term? And the answer is actually not much. But certainly the diet analogy, I think, is a brilliant one, and I'm going to be using that in the future, and I just wanted to say that. So terrific book. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thanks for your kind words. I appreciate them.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, you know, you make the point that, broadly speaking, the market seems to have a bias to rise slightly over time. And maybe that's the best prediction we can make for the market.
Right. It does seem that over time you make money in the market. It's not like casinos where if you stay there long enough, you'll lose money, as
right.
William Bennett can certainly attest,
yeah,
among many millions of others.
But there is, in one of the chapters near the end of the book, you describe power laws and how if you model the behavior of the stock market over time, it actually seems to conform more, instead of it sort of being, you know, a sort of bell-shaped curve in terms of the expected returns of various, you know, points in time and in various portions of the market, it seems to behave more like an earthquake.
That's true. I mean, in the middle of... For small returns, either positive or negative, that are the result of a myriad of investors making independent decisions and the market zigzags back and forth, it's basically a normal curve. But occasionally, for lots of reasons, one of which is the kind of interconnectedness of business media and brokerage firms, CNBC, and relatively few players, occasionally they align investors in one direction, and are these big volatility spikes, either up or down, that are described by so-called power laws. They come about more frequently than you would expect if your returns were described by a normal curve. The so-called tails of the curve are fatter, and these days on which there are big moves are not as rare as you might expect. So there's, you know, it's kind of glib to say, well, a normal distribution describes everything, because that only works when everybody acts independently. And most of the time that's true, except sometimes when people line up in bubbles or crashes. And and this happens for actually poorly understood reasons in a variety of fields. I mean, earthquakes, traffic jams, frequency of words in a language, all sorts of phenomena described by so-called power laws. And the market is another one. So it's a beast whose behavior is not all that well understood.
Yeah. So in essence, it is essentially responding in the way any complex system would, and that you can't describe it by linear sorts of analytical tools.
Right. I mean, I think often the interactions among the players in the market, business media, brokerage firms, and so on, is and just the, you know, millions of individual investors, is very what's called nonlinear. The equations are, you know, involve squares and so on, cubes, logs, whatever, and as a result, chaos in the mathematical sense often results where where small differences lead to disproportionate effects. I mean, it happens all the time where a stock comes in a penny under earnings, and people act like the sky has fallen in, or two cents over, and people react in the same way, but in the positive direction. Well, one thing that's interesting is that one reason for the appeal of various technical tools or other tools as well is that people are not all that good at recognizing randomness, so they tend to attribute significance to what is often just random fluctuation. If for example, you have people write down a sequence of 100 symbols, H's and T's for heads and tails, and tell them that this should be what they would imagine 100 flips of a coin would result in, you'd always be able to tell their sequence of 100 H's and T's from one generated by a real coin. And the reason is people don't put in enough consecutive H's or consecutive T's, and they don't make these strings long enough. And the difference between the total number of heads and the total number of tails switches back and forth too frequently when people make up the sequence. It switches back and forth relatively rarely when coins do. And as a result, since they have a poor idea of what randomness really is, there's, as I say, this natural tendency. It transcends the stock market. In fact, a lot of these issues I talk about in the market, kind of link to other issues. There's a tendency to always read significance into randomness. I mean, it's sort of what the Bible codes is about. People look hard enough for so-called equidistant letter sequences, and then once they find something, they go public with it, and it is, superficially it seems impressive until you realize how long they've spent looking. And you can find the same sorts of predictions in Moby Dick, but nobody attributes them to anything other than chance there.
Well, we just have a minute left, and I guess I want to ask, we spent a fair amount of time debunking the tools of technical analysis and sort of the rationale that people use to make decisions about the stock market. Is it like reading tea leaves? I mean, or is there a rational way to interact with the stock market?
Well, I think there's all kinds of ways you can do worse than the averages. I mean, I think there's a certain value to understanding how things work. I mean, I talk about options and calls and, as I say, fundamental analysis. I mean, even just understanding why the likely returns that you'll receive are less than the average returns cited. I mean, you might think, well, those are the average returns, I should get those. But the likely returns are generally much less. And I give examples to illustrate why. And there's a value, I think, in understanding the kind of logic of the market, having a kind of conceptual map of the market, which will, I think, make one perhaps less vulnerable to all sorts of hype and con games and scams, which I discuss in the book. And as I say, I mean, there are all kinds of ways to do much worse than index funds. And I think having a feel for the market, the way it works, the basic mathematics of these various techniques, and how margin calls work, and so on, is of some value. I mean, most books tend to just, as I say, give you 10 stocks for the new millennium and how you're going to be a millionaire in 8 short months.
And your book does much more than that. We're going to have to leave it there. The book is A Mathematician Plays the Stock Market. The author has been our guest, John Allen Paulos, last name spelled P-A-U-L-O-S. And to you, Professor Paulos, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.